All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and this is the Grim Article Show Supplementary. So let me go ahead and get started. So we got an article from Business Insider here. It says Google is scaling back its AI search plans after the summary feature told people to eat glue. Ugh. Google is scaling back AI-generated answers and search results after users noticed errors. The AI Overviews feature was launched 2 weeks ago and has faced backlash for false and absurd responses. One person said that they were thinking about ending their life, and of course the first couple results are like, oh yeah, there's some things you can do, you know, besides that. But a very popular Reddit post suggested jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. I laughed my ass off. Google is implementing changes to detect nonsensical queries and limit content from forums. Yeah, that's probably what they found. Whoa, that told somebody to jump off a bridge. We'd better do something about that or they'll hold us responsible for the death of the idiot. Is any idiot that's like, well, Reddit told me to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, so here I go! Woo! Okay. Google is pulling back the use of AI-generated answers and search results after the feature made some infamous errors, including telling users to put glue in their pizza sauce. Google launched AI Overviews 2 weeks ago, putting AI-generated summaries of search results at the top of the page for U.S. users. Over the past few days, users, including an SEO, search engine optimization expert, have noticed fewer of the overviews and suspected the tech giant is taking them down a notch after receiving criticism. It's not possible to turn off the AI feature while using the search engine. Google's head of search, Liz Reed, confirmed on a blog post on Thursday that the company was addressing some of these issues. The changes have come after examples of AI overviews going haywire and fake screenshots of the feature flooded the internet. These included search responses claiming that Barack Obama was a Muslim president, that Africa had no countries beginning with the letter K, and that people should eat at least one small rock per day. Yeah, they were telling people to eat pebbles. Google's new guardrails include detecting nonsensical queries that shouldn't show AI results, limiting satire or humor content, and introducing restrictions for prompts in which AI results wouldn't be helpful because there isn't enough data. Google's own ads show that the erroneous summaries aren't limited to a few viral queries. In a demo video released 2 weeks ago, the overview feature gave the wrong advice on how to fix a film camera. Give me a second, I've got a... wipe my glasses off. There we are. Reed also said in her blog post that Google had limited content from forums or social media, which can have misleading advice, definitely. Forums are often a great source of authentic first-hand information, but in some cases can lead to less than helpful advice, like using glue to get cheese to stick to pizza, Reed wrote in the post. Reed wrote that the company already had systems in place to not show AI-generated news or health-related results. She said some harmful results have encouraged people to smoke while pregnant or leave their dogs in cars were faked screenshots. The list of changes is the latest example of the big tech giant launching an AI product and circling back with restrictions after things get messy. Earlier this year, Google AI's image generating feature came under fire for refusing to produce pictures of white people. It was criticized for being too woke and creating images with historical inaccuracies, such as images of Asian Nazis and black founding fathers. In a blog post a few weeks later, Google leadership apologized and paused the feature. Oh, man. Okay, so it says a surprising number of people use and like the new search. No. Apparently, they don't want me to do this. So, no, that's not it. Oh wow, are we gonna do this in real time? That might not be a good idea. Oh, come on. I know that's gotta be... Is it new? Well, while that's doing its thing, we'll go to another article. Because I'm not going to sit here and wait for that, and neither are you. It's interesting, though. Hold on. Let me... Okay, so it says 6. Hold on. Let's go back. That's weird. Well, we'll look at it later and see what it does. Anyway. Millionaire gave up riches to prove he could remake $1 million reveals why he quit midway. This is interesting. Many wealthy individuals still seek out new challenges even after achieving financial success. Millionaire YouTuber Mike Black embarked on a daring task, relinquishing all his wealth to prove that he could earn it back within a year. Man, that's daunting, isn't it? However, personal issues forced him to quit the challenge halfway through, and a video titled Why I'm Starting Over During a Global Pandemic from July 2020, Black announced that he'd leave his seven-figure business as part of the million-dollar comeback challenge. He was trying to show us all that you just gotta, you know, what was it, bootstraps and all that, right, guys? He stated... I'll be putting all my belongings in storage. I'll be draining my bank account to zero, and I won't even have a place to live. Moreover, he severed all personal and professional ties to truly start from scratch. The YouTuber was inspired by witnessing widespread suffering due to the global shutdown, so he wanted to undertake the social experiment to give people hope and practical steps to reinvent themselves. Black reasoned, believe it or not, right now is actually one of the best times to be an entrepreneur. Despite his commendable effort, Black had to abandon his unique experiment due to health concerns. He posted a video in which he shared why he was quitting the project. The creator said, I've officially decided to end the project early now, as much as it hurts me to do this, especially with just 2 months left. I feel like it's the right thing to do. His health deteriorated soon after he began his quest to regain his millionaire status. Diagnosed with 2 autoimmune diseases affecting his joints and mobility, he found it difficult to continue. Wow, interesting. Damn. It escalated to the point where he developed a tumor on his hip that caused him a lot of pain every day. He shared, and I've been neglecting it because of the project. I've decided I just need to drop everything and focus on nothing but putting this in remission. Black further added that he'd come up with a plan to tackle all of his health problems completely. Yet his health issues were just a start, with more setbacks emerging throughout his social experiment. Black was informed that his dad only had a year to live, and he also had put $300,000 into a failed project. All of this made the experience much less enjoyable for him, and he realized that he wanted to put his time and energy into other things that mattered more. Black talked about how the project had been initially very fun, with him making a lot of progress in the first few days alone. He placed a huge emphasis on maintaining one's health, and in one of his clips talked about the probability of engaging in such social experiments again in the future. Well? I mean, it happens. He's like, well, I'm gonna lose all my money and get it real back and show you how to do it. And then God says, oh, you are you? I mean, that's literally what happened. I understand why he was trying to do it. Like, he was trying to show how anybody can become super rich in 12 months. But, didn't seem like that was in the plans for him. I mean, we do wish him the best of health. I don't want to wish anybody ill. But, yeah. Sometimes things happen. Okay, so a little old, but Canadian officials and experts have lambasted an anti-porn senator's age verification bill. Ottawa, Canada. Canada's privacy commissioner wanted a parliamentary committee on Tuesday that warned a parliamentary committee on Tuesday that the expansive age verification bill promoted by vocal anti-porn and anti-sex work Senator Julie Melville Deschanel has broad censorship implications and could end up applying to mainstream services such as Netflix. Grim wants to know what this woman looks like. What does woman look like? I must know. We will do, what's it called? New tab to the right. I love this feature. Paste. Oh, good Lord. We don't have anything of that old, of this woman. Well, this old bag, she wants to crack down on porn in Canada. Has broad censorship implications and could end up applying to mainstream services such as Netflix. Commissioner Philip Philippe Dufresne suggested the scope of the bill should be dramatically narrowed to address concerns about what types of content would be affected, the Canadian press reported. Canadian Heritage Deputy Minister Owen Ripley also testified, calling Melville Deschanel's bill highly problematic for a number of reasons, including a scope that is much too broad, both in terms of regulated service as well as regulated content. The Canadian press reported that University of Ottawa law professor and internet expert Michael Geist called the bill fundamentally flawed, explaining that age verification technology is simply not there yet. It isn't. To accomplish what censorship proponents like Melville Deschanel and her U.S.-based allies and counterparts are seeking. An unelected politician with peculiar U.S. allies. As XBiz reported, Melville Deschanel, a unelected official since Canadian senators are appointed, is a former journalist and broadcaster with no specialized knowledge about internet protocols or technical aspects of content moderation. In June 2021, Melville Deschanel, or whatever her fucking name is, I think I've said her name wrong, but I don't give a shit, neither do you, spoke to Francophone CBC outlet Radio Canada about the anti-Pornhub crusade, then being spearheaded by MP Arnold Viersen with the support of anti-porn crusader Lila Micklewaite, who at the time, okay, what does this woman look like? Grim, do you have to really... Yes, I do. I'm curious. Well, now! Oh, we don't want to go there. My book and all this other shit. Okay, well, we don't want to go there. But, okay. So I've been foiled, damn it. She's actually attractive. I guess she was like a former star or something. I don't have no idea. Who at the time worked for the Christian organization Exodus Cry. Michelle Deschanel told Radio Canada that she does not share the ideology of Exodus Cry, but tackles the issue of sexual exploitation under a feminist angle. And she certainly looks like a feminist, doesn't she, fellas? The issue of children watching online porn, as well as the presence of illegal content on porn sites, have gathered a large coalition of Canadian citizens who are ideologically different but who agree with each other on these two precise objectives, she added. However, in April 2022, she stated that protecting children against porn is both a health and public safety issue, echoing NCOSC and Exodus Cry terminology about an alleged public health crisis around watching porn and about porn addiction, a concept that has been repeatedly debunked. During Tuesday's hearing, this crazy woman and her supporters, well, she's not as crazy as the other one, but you'd probably rather, you'd want to bang the crazy one. But isn't that how it always is? Is that woman even married? I don't know. No, I'm not interested in her. I'm just serious if there's a man in her life at all. Is she? Let me see. Now that would be some interesting information. There we are. Now, let me look at that. Married. I don't see no man. I don't hear if a... She's been an expert for combating the injustice of sex trafficking. Well, yeah, I mean, we don't necessarily need to have that going on. Absolutely. Like, real sex trafficking, no. That's that, Sound of Freedom shit. I don't go for that. That's awful. But if she's like, oh, we gotta ban all the porn because of Jesus. Like, no. I don't see a man. I literally do not see. Does it say? About. Yeah, child abuse, sex trafficking, rape, and the criminal exploitation of countless victims. Like, yeah, that's good. I'm glad. And of course, they're trying to shut down Pornhub, which they really need to. Let's see. She got her Master of Public Diplomacy degree from the Edinburgh University of Southern California, Los Angeles, U.S. Department of State. Yeah, a bunch of papers. So, yeah, I'm okay with... Nobody's married this woman? Like, nobody? What does she look like without the makeup? Like, come on now. All you traditional men out there. Oh, I don't want no porn. We gotta get rid of all the porn. Porn's a horrible thing. You be a man like me. Well, there's your woman. She's not for porn either. You can marry this woman, and you can have a family and a good Christian lifestyle. Where are you, Mr. Trans Man? Where are you? This woman clearly is not, doesn't have a family, no kids. She's just getting older and older. I mean, come on now, folks. And, you know, not to talk shit about what she's literally doing, because sex trafficking is a real fucking problem. 100%. So we're not gonna beat around the bush about that. We know from reports that the BBC has conducted that several missing persons were found on there, and there's a lot of gang activity, and I'm not talking about Pornhub in general. I'm talking about OnlyFans. OnlyFans is a wretched hive of scum and villainy, as it has been so said. So yeah, it's a bad thing. But I don't get why old Micklewaite doesn't have a man. Maybe, no, he's married. I was gonna say, oh, damn. See, if DP were here, he'd be able to give me the answer. What's that guy that has problems with porn and anime and everything else in the world? I can't remember his name. He's married. The one that I went to school with. I don't know. I can't remember. Anyway. We're going to X that out. Anyway. Her supporters argue that the bill's purpose is to shield minors from sexually graphic and violent material is important enough that it should be passed, with the technical details to be sorted out through a regulatory process, the Canadian Press reported. Academic expert Geis retorted that the bill is fundamentally defective in its current form, and it can't be fixed without a complete overhaul, and that the technology simply doesn't exist to permit age verification at scale. Ripley added that, as written, the proposed law would make it a rule for services like Netflix to verify the age of their users, having far-reaching implications for how Canadians access and use the internet. Website blocking remains a highly contentious enforcement instrument that poses a range of challenges and could impact Canadians' freedom of speech and Canada's commitment to an open and free internet and net neutrality. Dufresne, or whatever the hell that person's name is, suggested an amendment that narrowed the scope of the bill to services providing sexually explicit material for commercial purposes. So, she isn't going as crazy as the hot crazy lady, but, yeah, they're still trying to pass this shit. So, yeah. There you have it. America is sick of swiping. Maybe that's why this woman can't find a man. She's swiped and swiped and swiped. And this man said he loves Jesus and hates porn. This man said he loves Jesus and hates porn. This man here, he said he loves Jesus and hates porn. But none of them are good enough. It's like, lady, he loves Jesus, he hates porn. That should be all right there. That should be it. Like, bing, bing, bing. Dating apps are falling back to earth. Okay, so modern them and their fucking trials. Let's see if this is done. Not yet. It doesn't seem like it's gonna do it at all, so I don't know. Maybe it's because I have to put that -6 in there. Try it again. See, when I do this on my phone, it works. It just fucking works. But you know what? Here's what we're gonna do. New tab to the right. Once again, archive. No. Not that. Grim and technology, huh? It's amusing sometimes. I'm sure you guys are laughing. Okay. This one doesn't have one either? Are you serious? Boom! I got it! Okay. Bottom, not the top. So, America is sick of swiping. Dating apps are falling back to earth by Laura Kelly. Modern dating can be severed into two eras, before the swipe and after. When Tinder and other dating apps took off in the early 2010s, they unleashed a way to more easily access a potential love interest than ever before. By 2017, about 5 years after Tinder introduced the swipe, more than a quarter of different sex couples were meeting on apps and dating websites, according to a study led by the Stanford sociologist Michael Rosenfeld. Suddenly saying we met on Hinge was as normal as saying we met in college or we met through a friend. The share of couples meeting on apps has remained pretty consistent in the years since his 2017 study that Rosenfeld has told me. But these days, the mood around dating apps has soured. As the apps seek to woo a new generation of daters, TikTok abounds with complaints about how hard it is to find a date on Tinder, Hinge, Bumble, Grindr, and all the rest. The novelty of swiping is worn off, and there hasn't been a major innovation beyond it. As they push more paid features, the platforms themselves are facing rocky finances and stalling growth. Dating apps once looked like the foundation of American romance. Now the cracks are starting to show. In 2022, a Pew Research survey found that about half of people have a positive experience with online dating, down from October 2019. With little success on the apps, a small but enthusiastic slice of singles are reaching for speed dating and matchmakers. Even the big dating apps seem aware that they are facing a crisis of public enthusiasm. A spokesperson for Hinge told me that Gen Z is facing its fastest growing user segment through the CEO of Match Group, the parent company of Tinder and Hinge. Has gone on the defensive. Last week, he published an op-ed headline, "Dating apps are the best place to find love, no matter what you see on TikTok." A spokesperson for Bumble told me that the company is actively looking at how we can make dating fun again. That's when I talked about the apps. The AI. Yeah, remember, you're going to date the AI version of the person? Empress said that sounded like a good idea. I don't know. But you date their AI, and if you hit it off with the AI, basically, you can date them. Sounds weird, right? But I don't know. In part, what has changed is the world around the apps, Rosenfeld said. The massive disruptions of the pandemic meant that young people missed out on a key period to flirt and date, and they're all still suffering from that, he told me. Compared with previous generations, young people today also have a greater comfort with singleness, Catherine Cadotto, a professor of media science at Boston University, told me. But if the ads feel different lately, it's because they are different. People got used to swiping their hearts out for free. Now the apps are further turning to subscriptions and other paid features. Tinder, for example, lost a $499 a month premium subscription in December. On Hinge, you can signal special interest in someone's profile by sending them a rose, which then puts you at the top of their feed. Everyone gets one free rose a week, but you can pay for more. Hinge users have accused the app of gatekeeping attractive people in rose jail, but a spokesperson for the app defended the feature. Hinge's top goal is to help people go on dates, she said, claiming that roses are twice as likely to lead to one. It's the same process that has afflicted Google, Amazon, Uber, and so many other platforms in recent years. First, an app achieves scale by providing a service lots of people want to use, and then it does whatever is needed to make money off you. This has worked for some companies. After 15 years, Uber is finally profitable. But monetization is especially tricky for dating apps. No matter how much you fork over, apps can't guarantee that you'll meet the love of your life or even have a great first date. With dating apps, you're basically paying for a chance, Cododo told me. Paying for a dating app subscription can feel like entering a lottery. Exciting, but potentially a waste of money, with an added dose of worry that you look desperate. And there's always been a paradox at the core of the apps. They promise to help you meet people, but they make money if you keep swiping. That's true. The perfect man who wasn't. Over the past few years, the big dating companies have faltered as businesses. Tinder saw its paid users fall by nearly 10% in 2023, and the big apps have been beset by layoffs and leadership changes. Bumble and Match Group have seen their stock prices plummet as investors grow frustrated. Perhaps the biggest problem that the apps might face is not that people are abandoning them en masse, they aren't, but that even a small dip could prove detrimental. The current big app's edge relies on lots of people using them. Apps such as Tinder and Grindr have an enormous network advantage over newcomers, Rosenfeld said, for the same reasons that Facebook does. It's not that they're amazing, it's that they're giant. If you want to meet other single people, the apps are where other single people are. It's true. So far, the big app's efforts to avoid this doom have involved the same basic feature that has been around since the beginning, swiping. We're essentially at a tipping point for at least this version of the technology, Cadotto said. Like so many other industries, dating apps swear they have the answer, AI. George Arison, the CEO of Grindr, told me that the app plans to use AI with users' permission to suggest chat topics and power an AI wingman feature, and to scan for spam and illegal activity, which they need to be doing anyway. Hinge's CEO has suggested that AI will help the app coach users and enable people to find matches, and a product leader at Tinder said last month that the app has used AI to power safety features, adding that the tech can help users select their profile photos. That would be kind of neat, if it worked. Alright, so when is this AI going to start telling people to use filters? Like, it's only a matter of time before Tinder, Tinder, Bumble, you know, those apps start saying, sir, madam, hate to say it, but you are considered ugly. And in order to fix this, we want to help you design a photo with our filters in our AI app that we partner with, so that you'll look attractive and people will have a bigger chance of selecting you. So, that might not be a good thing. I don't have any idea. Again, I still think that people like the AI better than the person they date, because Bumble kept saying that they were going to have people date the AI. But as I've said, man, there's a lot of people that really love the AI. So they'd be like, well, you know, I don't want to date you because I think the AI that you're using here is more interesting to talk to than you are. Or they could bring it to the person and they were like, you know what? Switch me back to the AI. This person is pretty fucking dumb. Unfortunately, that's how things can be. Imagine you're dating somebody, right? And, well, let's step it back a little bit. You're on a dating app and you're going to date somebody and you go to date the AI first, and the AI is eloquent. You know, speech is real good. Basically, doesn't have any grammatical or spelling errors. Seems to be very knowledgeable about many topics. Seems to give a shit and care about you. And then all of a sudden you go to the person who is not eloquent. Tons of speech errors, grammar errors, can't spell to save their life. Non-interested, says really fucking stupid shit. And you're like, you know what? I'll take the robot. The robot acted like it gave a shit. You don't. And that's what's going to happen. It's going to backfire. But maybe that's their plan. Creepy music for that, right?
Maybe that's their plan all along. Ha 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 ha.
Anyway, Hinge's CEO that suggested that AI, I forgot about Hinge, will help the app coach users and enable people to find matches. And a product leader at Tinder said last month that the app has used AI to power safety features, adding that the technology can help users select their profile photos. Okay, I said that before, but Hinge was always the one that I could never get anything on because there wasn't enough people in my area. I mean, there is now with the casino, because Hinge, what it does is it finds people that are in your vicinity. So now that I live next to a giant casino, I'm sure I get all kinds of just everybody in the world. And they'd all be in that casino. And they'd all be bad news. Because there's nothing but fucking bad news bears in there. Like, I know the guy that works at the tobacco shop, and he's bringing in God knows what floozies from this casino, because he's always there. I'm sure you can get a lot of poon, but my God, the risk you take. And you say, grim, but life is about risk. Yes, but there's some risks that I am not willing to take. God knows where those women have been, right? My mother always said, put that down, Grim. You don't know where it's been. And that can be true for some of those ladies there. Maybe more than we expect, because, you know, there's not a lot. I mean, casinos used to have a reputation for being classy. But DP's told me how the women dress, and they're not dressing for class. It's not the 50s, guys. It's a completely different age. These women are dressing to show all ass and everything else, as much as they can get away with. It's like working at a whorehouse, I'm sure. But AI also holds the potential to unleash chaos on the apps. Bot-written messages and bot-written profiles don't exactly sound like a recipe for finding love. You might be surprised. For Gen Z, the future may hold a grab bag of sliding into DMs, reluctant swiping, and generally doing what humans have always done, seek companionship and love through any means they can muster. With all the time spent online now, people are finding love on Strava, Discord, and Snapchat, among them. They're not finding love on there, I can assure you of that. In any sense, any app can be a dating app. Traditional dating apps might be most useful not to young people, but to those middle-aged and older with money to spare. they are more likely to be part of thin dating markets or segments of the population where the number of eligible partners is relatively small. Reuben Thomas, a professor at the University of New Mexico, told me. You know, as opposed to old Mexico. Online dating is really useful for people. Why don't we just call Mexico old Mexico? It's like, we got New Mexico there, and we got old Mexico. Boom. Old Mexico. Just make it happen. And this is really useful for people who don't have that rich dating environment in their offline lives, Thomas said. In this way, the future dating apps may look more like their past, a place for older dates to go after exhausting other options. In the 2000s, the heyday of OkCupid, eHarmony, and desktop dating. I remember all that fucking bullshit. I did meet some people on there, though. Back in the day, you could. Middle-aged people were the power users. I didn't know that. Thomas said. Well, Thomas said that. I didn't say that. Millennials had their fun on Tinder in the 2010s. That they did. And many found lasting relationships. I don't know about that. But as a top choice for young people looking for love, dating apps may have been a blip. On D-Day, the U.S. conquered the British Empire. We showed them. Of course, I'm totally on a British site. So, hey, it's cool. Don't go crazy. We're okay with the Brits. I'm not about to slander Britain on a British platform. I believe we're UK. Bet you it's UK, if I'm not mistaken. Good people there in the UK, right? Great people. All right, moving on. What happens to your GOG account if you die? You know what happens to your Steam account, right? Well, what happens to your GOG account if you just blah? GOG confirms policy. Good Old Games has given some clarity as to what happens to your digital game library when you pass away. In a statement provided to Respawn First, GOG addressed the issue directly, as this is a particularly delicate matter with little to no existing legal guidance on the issue of video games preservation. We'd like to address it properly so that you and every other GOG community member can be sure what can happen to your games in case of unexpected events such as death. One significant challenge GOG highlighted is the anonymity of its users. GOG does not collect information sufficient to truly identify a particular person, such as a name and surname, or their family or marital status. For this reason, we're not able to establish that someone is related to a particular user or that a particular user has passed away, the statement explained. However, GOG is open to working with legal documents to transfer accounts. In general, your GOG account and GOG content is not transferable. However, if you can obtain a copy of a court order that specifically entitles someone to your GOG personal account, we'll do our best to make it happen. GOG also emphasizes willingness to cooperate. We're willing to handle such situations and preserve your GOG library, but currently need the help of the justice system. GOG added, it's worth mentioning, however, that GOG game builds are DRM-free and offline installers are included with every purchase. That way, if someone wants to save their offline games on, for example, an external hard drive, they'll be preserved regardless of the account ownership. This announcement comes after Steam confirmed on its own policy on the matter. Steam's customer support stated that Steam accounts and games are non-transferable. Steam support can't provide someone else with access to the account or merge its contents with another account. Your Steam account cannot be transferred via a will. I also contacted Epic Games for its store policy on account inheritance, but so far I haven't heard back. I did receive a response from customer service, which I'm sharing below. Note that this response is from someone who's clearly a non-English-speaking person and may not have correctly understood the question. Anyway, from what I could understand, Epic Games does not allow account transfers in case of death. As it stands, GOG is the least problematic store when it comes to account inheritance and preservation due to its willingness to cooperate and no DRM. Sony's new tech lets you create mini games out of your gameplay. That's weird. I like, let's do this one. The launch of Cyberpunk 2077 felt like a personal failure. Whoops, did I do something wrong? I guess I did, didn't I? Still learning this internet stuff. All right, there we go. The launch of Cyberpunk 2077 felt like a personal failure, says associate director. Needless to say, the launch of Cyberpunk 2077 was rough. Remember, we did play the 1.0 version on this channel. And we had a few bugs, but it wasn't terrible. It's definitely much better now. The game had a ton of issues, including bugs, missing features, broken AI, and horrible performance on last-gen consoles. Post-launch Cyberpunk 2077 started its successful redemption arc that was completed with Phantom Liberty. But the journey wasn't easy. Reminiscing about the launch days of Cyberpunk 2077, associate game director Pawel Sasko revealed how he felt when the game was in the middle of a rocky launch. So many things were so different from The Witcher, and I felt like there's so much growth happening, even though it was tough as hell to make this game. And then the release was really heartbreaking, you know? And in a way, I felt that it was in my way a my own personal failure. That I failed to grow in a way I wanted. It really hurts like hell, you know, everything. Going to social media, you know, seeing like everything I said or did, you know, before the release, meme to death, getting death threats, all that stuff. It really, really did hurt, you know. But I felt that the growth is happening and put all that work into the patches and Phantom Liberty. So now with Orion, it's like, I want to keep doing that and really have all that experience. And we sometimes with Dan, we talk about like really deep scars that were left. And I think those are not wounds anymore. I think those are scars. But in a way, I'm one of those people that when they are scarred, they kind of like tattoo, you know, things around those scars and cherish those scars. They tell a story. I'm kind of like this, you know. Project Orion was announced on October 4th, 2022. The core team working on Cyberpunk sequel has moved to Boston to work on the game full time. Now, let me see if this is true. We'll go to this in a second, but I do want to show you this. Let's see. Ken Grimtype. Staff. All right. I'm not seeing it, but I did. Wonder if it would have. I'm not seeing it. Yeah, I know. I don't see it. Fortunately, I'm not seeing it. But there was a picture on X that showed all these, basically all these girls as the staff in Boston. Huh. let's just go right here. Boston Archives? New? I don't know. Like, I'm not seeing anything. I mean, Boston office. You can get a job there. They need a gameplay engineer. A lot of people say the game is not going to be that great, though, because of, some obvious changes. But guys, this game isn't coming out till 2027 at the latest. 2028, maybe. I mean, it might. Because they're working on The Witcher 4 right now. And The Witcher 4 probably won't come out to 2025, 2026. So this might not come out to 2027. It might be 2028. You'll be playing Grand Theft Auto 6 before you'll be playing Cyberpunk Orion. So just keep that in mind. So, okay. Most people couldn't give a crap about using AI, survey finds. Many of them have never even heard of ChatGPT. Hyperdysphoria. While CEOs and investors rush to jam AI into as many products as possible, the general public seems unable to give a hoot. And a new study conducted by Oxford University and the Reuters Institute that asked roughly 12,000 people in 6 countries about AI. Large swaths of residents said that they'd never used popular tools like OpenAI's ChatGPT or Microsoft Copilot, and between 20 and 30% said they'd never even heard of them. Using the YouGov platform, the researchers asked 2,000 people, each in Argentina, Denmark, France, Japan, the United States, and the United Kingdom, a battery of questions related to AI. From how often they use programs and their familiarity with various brand names to whether they trusted the tools and the people using them. The results were surprising, to say the least, suggesting companies are vastly overestimating how much the general public cares about AI. Large parts of the public are not particularly interested in generative AI, Richard Fletcher, the Reuters Institute's research director and the lead author of the study, told the BBC, which highlights a mismatch between the hype surrounding the tech and the public's interest in it. When asked whether they trust generative AI outputs, the results were even more stark. Across ages and nationalities, an overwhelming percentage of respondents said that they hadn't used AI tools enough to trust or distrust its outputs, be they writing emails, answering questions, or getting the latest news. Another substantial percentage across demographics said they either didn't know enough about the topic or were ambivalent when it came to trusting AI. Unsurprisingly, younger people seemed far more likely to respond that they had used the tools, with 58% across all 6 countries saying they used ChatGPT at least once, compared to the 16% of people 55 or older who said they tried it. In that same vein, younger people also seemed more likely to expect AI to change their own lives significantly, with more than half of the respondents expected it to change politics, journalism, and science. People's hopes and fears for generative AI vary a lot depending on the sector, Fletcher told the BBC. People are generally optimistic and about the use of generative AI in science and healthcare, but more wary about it being used in news and journalism, and worried about the effect it might have on job security. The overarching message, according to the research director, is one of nuance, not just for the populace forced to reckon with AI, but for business and policy leaders who are thrusting it upon them. It's important to keep this quite nuanced and differentiated set of expectations in mind in interpreting people's general expectations around what impact they think generative AI will have for them personally, the study reads, as well as for society at large. OpenAI Insider said they're being silenced about danger. Country star who can't sing after stroke releases new song using AI. Cops using AI that automatically generates police reports from body cam footage. Well, that doesn't sound that great. That sounds really fucking bad. And that was in April, so that was way back. But there you go. Okay. So, this is some interesting information. Researchers identified genetic cause of intellectual disability affecting tens of thousands. Novel study links genetic changes in a non-coding gene called RNU4-2 to neurodevelopmental disorders. Researchers at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and others have identified a neurodevelopmental disorder caused by mutations in a single gene that affects tens of thousands of people worldwide. The work, published in the May 31st online issue of Nature Medicine, was done in collaboration with colleagues at the University of Bristol, UK, KU Leuven, Belgium, and the Near Bioresource, currently based at the University of Cambridge, UK. The findings will improve clinical diagnostic services for patients with neurodevelopmental disorders. Through rigorous genetic analysis, the researchers discovered that mutations in a small non-coding gene called RNU4-2 cause a collection of developmental symptoms that had not been previously tied to a distinct genetic disorder. Non-coding genes are parts of DNA that do not produce proteins. The investigators used whole genome sequencing data in the United Kingdom's National Genomic Research Library to compare the burden of rare genetic variants in 41,132 non-coding genes between 5,529 unrelated cases with intellectual disability and 46,401 unrelated controls. Is this a real long study? Yeah, it is. So, not really. Because they stop it there. The discovery is significant, as it represents one of the most common single gene genetic causes of such disorders, ranking second only to Rett syndrome among patients sequenced by the UK's Genomic Medicine Service. Notably, these mutations are typically spontaneous and not inherited, providing important insights into the nature of the condition. Let's see. So, I'm not really seeing anything. Okay, what I found remarkable is how such a common cause of a neurodevelopmental disorder has been missed in the field because we've been focusing on coding genes, says Heather Meffert, MD, PhD, of the Center for Pediatric Neurological Disease Research at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, who was not involved with the research. The study's discovery of mutations in non-coding genes, especially RNU4-2, highlights a significant and previously overlooked case. It underscores the need to look beyond coding regions, which could reveal many other genetic causes, opening new diagnostic possibilities and research opportunities. So there you go. That's some interesting information, I guess you could say. Maybe not as interesting as it sounded at first, but yeah. We like to divvy it up, you know. Okay, Silent Hill 2 remake devs resisted changes from original creators. You've probably seen this before because, yeah, it's June 6th. Silent Hill 2 remake producer Motoi Okamoto has revealed that developer Bloober Team actually pushed back against certain changes that the original game's creators wanted to make, as it would have turned out to be a completely different remake. Silent Hill 2 remake developers Bloober Team has struggled to get fans of the original game on board in recent weeks, with each new trailer giving one set of fans something to be excited about while angering another. Both of the game's more recent trailers, including a 13-minute long gameplay demonstration, have more dislikes than likes on YouTube, and the character models for Angela and Maria have come under tense scrutiny this past week. Bloober Team needs some more positivity at the moment, which is why it makes Silent Hill 2 remake producer Motoi Okamoto's comments about the developer resisting changes from the game's original creators all the more perplexing. In an interview with Famitsu, translated by VGC, Okamoto claims that the staff that worked on the original game, including Pyramid Head creator Masahiro Ito, and sound designer Akira Yamaoka, wanted to change parts of the game, but Bloober Team refused. Japanese staff, including Masahiro Ito, the designer who worked on the original version, and Akira Yamaoka, the sound designer, said, "We want to change this part." While on the other hand, Bloober Team often replied saying, "No, we don't want to change this." Sometimes the opinions clashed, but in the end, I think we managed to get it right. Silent Hill 2's original creators wanted to completely change the remake. When asked why the original developers wanted to change so much in the remake, Okamoto thinks it was partly a desire to have players experience something new, as game creators don't want to make the same thing they created all over again. Okamoto goes on to praise Bloober Team for standing strong and creating a highly respectful remake as a result. He even claims that if the development team for Silent Hill 2 remake had been formed in Japan with the developers of the original on board, it could have potentially been a completely different remake. Unfortunately, it seems as though Bloober Team was adamant on a faithful remake, so we'll never know what the original creators wanted to do with Silent Hill 2. I mean, Maybe we will.
Maybe we will.
Save that one for later. Oh, save that one for later. Go back to that. Yeah, we can do this. Okay. Study reveals the cognitive superpowers of reading fiction. More than just words. New research shows that reading fiction boosts empathy, verbal skills, and cognitive ability. Yeah! I wonder if listening to fiction being read is the same. Maybe you guys are developing empathy, verbal skills, and cognitive ability by watching my videos. I don't know. Some of you are probably developing boners as well, or wetting in certain areas. Depending on what we're doing, of course. Like City of Broken Dreamers, tonight, right after this. Well, it's gonna drop a little early. I'm covering it right after this, but it's gonna drop, it'll drop tomorrow. This'll drop later. I could drop both, though. It is what it is. Reading is more than a leisure activity. It's a complex cognitive exercise that strengthens various mental muscles. While high-profile business leaders like Warren Buffett and Elon Musk have long extolled the virtues of reading for knowledge, the focus has predominantly been on nonfiction. Yet, a new study reveals that reading fiction may offer unique benefits. It may enhance cognitive abilities, particularly in verbal skills, empathy, and perspective-taking. The cognitive workout of literary fiction. While fiction has always been appreciated, its role in cognitive development is becoming clearer through systematic research. Lena Wimmer, a postdoctoral researcher at Julius Maximilian University of Würzburg, who's probably not interested in any of our content, sought to consolidate empirical evidence to assess the real-world cognitive impacts of reading fiction. Wimmer's team conducted two meta-analyses. The first focused on the immediate cognitive effects of reading fiction through experiments involving over 11,000 participants. For instance, some of these experiments involved having participants read short stories and then perform a certain task that gauged a certain cognitive parameter. This analysis of over 70 studies highlighted a statistically significant, albeit small, boost in cognitive skills from reading fiction compared to engaging in other activities like watching fiction or simply doing nothing in particular. Notably, positive effects were observed in empathy and theory of mind, the ability to attribute mental states to oneself and others, or more simply, the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes, as I have always done when I've done these comics. And I say comics because obviously when we're doing most of the games, it's supposed to be like you. Like, you know, the main character is supposed to be you. But not all the time. The second meta-analysis reviewed the correlation between lifelong fiction reading and cognitive abilities across 114 studies and 30,000. We can almost say 31,000 individuals. It says 30,503, but it's around 30,000, 31,000. It's a lot of people, guys. It found a consistent positive relationship between extensive fiction reading and improved cognitive function. That is a very, very respectful study. For 30,000 individuals, or 31,000, that's a lot of fucking people, again. Effects were seen in verbal and general cognitive skills such as problem-solving, reasoning, and abstraction. The benefits of a narrative. These findings suggest that the act of reading narrative fiction might stimulate the brain in unique ways, providing certain benefits that are not as pronounced with other forms of media consumption. The impact also appears to differ based on the duration and frequency of engagement with fiction. I would like to see that. Together, these meta-analyses provide robust evidence for a small-sized positive relationship between reading fiction and cognitive benefits, the authors noted in their study. Future studies could help delineate the causal impacts of reading fiction on cognition and clarify how individual cognitive differences may interact with reading habits over time. Am I changing your brain? Maybe. Okay, we have a... Despite significantly increasing research effects, the psychological effects of reading fiction remain under debate. We present two pre-registered meta-analysis synthesizing cognitive effects and correlates of reading fiction. In meta-analysis 1, 371 effect sizes / 70 experiments, reading fiction led to significant small-size cognitive benefits, G equals 0.14, 95% confidence interval CI, 0.06, 0.21. This effect of fiction reading was moderated by the comparison group. Effects were greater when reading fiction was compared with watching fiction or reading nothing than when reading fiction was compared with empathy and mentalizing only. Hold on. I think I read that a little bit. Alright, we'll try that one again. This effect of fiction reading was moderated by the comparison group. Effects were greater when reading fiction was compared with watching fiction or reading nothing than when reading fiction was compared with reading nonfiction. And the outcome variable, significant effects emerge for empathy and mentalizing only. In meta-analysis 2, which is 559 effect sizes / 114 studies reporting correlations, lifetime exposure to print fiction was linked with significant small-size cognitive benefits, R equals 0.16, 95% CI, 0.13, 0.19. This effect was moderated by outcome variable. Effects were greatest for verbal abilities, followed by general cognitive abilities and empathy, mentalizing outgroup judgments. Fictionality of the print material, greater effects were found for fiction than nonfiction. Publication status, published work exhibited greater effects than unpublished work. Really? Now that I find fascinating. Type of assessment measure. Larger effects emerge when neither the outcome nor print exposure were assessed via self-report than when either the outcome or print exposure were... Than when either the outcome or print exposure were assessed via self-report. Participant group community samples showed greater effects than student samples. Study design, greater effects were found for correlational than for experimental designs. And percentage of female participants via a negative relationship with cognitive benefits. What? It doesn't work on women? Let me read that again. And percentage of female participants via a negative relationship with cognitive benefits. Apparently women don't get the same benefits. It's what it says here anyway. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Together, these meta-analyses provide robust evidence for a small-size positive relationship between reading fiction and cognitive benefits. Psych Info Database Record, 2024 APA, all rights reserved. This research project suggests that people who read a lot of fiction have better cognitive skills than people who read little or no fiction. Wow. The benefits are small in size across various cognitive skills, but of medium size for verbal and general cognitive abilities, for example, intelligence. Sorry. Importantly, there is a stronger association between reading fiction and cognitive skills than between reading nonfiction and those skills. However, whether the benefits are caused by reading fiction or by one or more other variables remains to be determined through future research. So, they're not 100% sure, but they have a lot of sources, and it seems like a pretty strong study. But no study... Again, no study is perfect. And all studies are subject to criticism. That's science. Everything needs to be critiqued because then it can be improved. How do you make a study stronger? By testing it. You test the experiment. It's always a scientific method. You use the scientific method to test the results of the scientific method. Just to make sure that the scientific method was executed properly. So at any rate, that'll be it for the Grim Article Show Supplemental, and I'll see you guys next time. I am out of here.